From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the July 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Pinches and Breaks. This month in our anniversary series, It Happened Here, we dive into stories of stolen intelligence treasures which helped turn the tide in the Battle of the Atlantic. We'll hear from Arnold Hargreaves, a seaman aboard HMS Bulldog, who boarded the captured German submarine U-110 and still has the spoils today. An Enigma machine, codebooks and other vital documents were among the haul taken from the U-boat before it was sunk. We join Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to delve into the tale of HMS Bulldog and other key pinches, which helped the codebreakers at Bletchley Park glean vital naval intelligence. Genius alone was not enough. Pinches, in other words, stealing stuff from the enemy, were vital in breaking naval codes. But first, Bletchley Park celebrated Armed Forces Weekend in style at the end of June. 2,000 free tickets were given to military personnel and their families, who were serenaded by live bands, and there were stalls and activities to entertain visitors of all ages. Podcast producer Mark Cotton went along, because you never know who you might meet at Bletchley Park.
Lieutenant Colonel Simon Wilkinson, Deputy Chairman of the Buckinghamshire and Milton Keynes Armed Forces Day Committee.
What does today mean to you and to the committee?
Well, it's the opportunity for the community of Buckinghamshire and Milton Keynes to thank the armed forces personnel and their families and their employers and the cadets for their service and for their commitment to the community and to the British people. And the local population can come here. They can understand a bit more about what defence does today, and they can share in the celebration of our service personnel.
This is one thing that we always try to do when we do our veterans interviews, because not enough people thank our armed forces or our veterans for their service, do they?
Well, it's changed a great deal since the Iraq War, and with things now like the Armed Forces Community Covenant and the Armed Forces Corporate Covenants, the recognition of what our service personnel do in society has grown enormously. And we're all very grateful for the recognition that we now get. And I say that as someone who served in Iraq myself, left my family here whilst I was away for 7 months, and they received the support of the community whilst I was on operations. Likewise, we are a family in the armed forces, and we're very well connected with places like Bletchley Park. And to come here on this occasion just seems an incredibly appropriate moment for us. And it's a great location because we have veterans like Arnold Hargreaves, who was actually on the boat that captured the Enigma machine.
I know, it's absolutely wonderful, isn't it? I mean, I think he's running rings around us today, isn't he?
Well, he's amazingly sprightly, and he's been in the display area. He's pointed to himself on U-boat 110 before it was sunk, and that was illuminating for all of us, and indeed, I think, for him to see himself up on the display.
People will be able to hear in this month's It Happened Here, later in this episode, exactly what Arnold did, and it is absolutely amazing. And he's so modest, as all veterans are, and I think most people in the armed services are very modest about what they do, and we owe them a great duty of thanks, don't we?
Well, yes, and I mean, there are a lot of service personnel here. Many of the people here today have served very recently, right the way back to a lot of the World War II vets that are also here today. And of course, their spouses are here too, and we must remember the commitment that the families make to support us when we're away on operations. For reservists today, of course, it's important from the employer's perspective, and as part of the sort of the big society, events like today and the fact that Bletchley Park are hosting it here today is very important.
It's wonderful, isn't it? And it may have been pouring with rain earlier, but the sun's come out now finally, hasn't it?
Yeah, the blue sky's out there, the sun is shining, but it's very difficult to wipe the smile off a serviceman, and often for us infantry soldiers, we're at our best when the chips are down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Colin McCarron, we're from Winslow.
Fantastic, and what brings you here today?
We've been here a number of times because we live not far, and Kevin and Sandra have been up just once before, and we had such a good day, didn't see it all.
So
this is the second half for Kevin and Sandra. Really.
So is it somewhere for you to meet halfway? Or
no, more than that, actually. It's to come to Bletchley Park, because Kevin and Sandra only saw half of it and all what you got.
Yeah, we wanted to experience it and finish it off. And Colin used to work here back in the days before the... Not during the war.
No,
definitely not.
So there's a bit of personal interest there for you,
yeah,
isn't there?
Yeah.
What did you do here?
I worked in the mansion for a while. So I worked for BT in the mansion for a while.
Oh, right.
And I worked for BT in the Management Training College, which one of the buildings that's been knocked down just past the computer centre.
Oh, right.
It tells a story that while you were here, you were completely unaware of what went on here at that time.
Yeah.
In the 80s, was it?
Yeah. Our office was the lounge on the right-hand side, just by where the posh cafe is now.
Oh, yeah.
And we used to pass our equipment, open those doors over those big radiators and pass the equipment out. And had no idea about the history of the place at that time. Yeah.
So it's been intriguing finding out for you.
Yeah, it's been fabulous. Because I was here for about 6 years, so some of my history is here. And... both of us were telephone engineers, so some of the equipment here we recognise.
Looks very familiar.
Going back before these digital pieces of equipment that we now carry as mobiles.
So, yeah.
Even the noise that the bomb makes is very familiar to anyone who's ever worked in a telephone exchange. It's a bit like going back in time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Trip down memory lane.
A little bit.
And then we have we separated and we met up just as the Glenn Miller music was playing.
Yeah.
You know, and our history with our parents and our father loving the music and Karen's... And so I'm just family loving the music, and we sort of stopped in our tracks, didn't we?
Brought us to a complete halt. Yeah, very special day already.
Yeah, good day.
Good. I'm really glad to hear it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good. And maybe you'll come back for a 40s day and dress up.
I
think they're planning on doing some pampering days as well for the girls, so you can get your hair done in the 40s style.
In the 40s style.
Oh, nice.
Those 40s dresses.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Not for you, though.
That. No, it's not for me.
Yeah, I'm sure you can come get your nails done as well.
Oh, saying that, yeah.
Well, thank you ever so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Sarah.
I'm Councillor Mimi Harker and I am the Chairman of Chiltern District Council.
This has been a brilliant day, hasn't it?
It has been an absolutely superb day, and you know, you couldn't have ordered the weather better either. So we've had a couple of showers, but the sun has been shining down on all of us and just made it such fun. And if you can hear that fantastic steel band in the background, well, that's the sort of thing that's made the day, because we've had a lot of amazing acts here as well. Lots of bands, lots of singers, and it's been great to catch up with people I know as well.
And it's just lovely that we can have this Armed Forces Day now, isn't it? It's the way of the community saying thank you, isn't it?
It is absolutely the way to say thank you. And it's not just about saying thank you, it's about remembering. It's about acknowledging, and not just those service men and women who gave their lives, but the ones who are serving now.
Exactly.
And it's not just about them either, it's about their families, because their families go through a huge amount to support them in the jobs they do. And that is whether you're a regular or whether you're a reservist, because the reservists have their own jobs as well during the daytime. So if you are involved with the armed forces, today is a fabulous way to say thank you so very much for what you do, and especially in a historic place like this. I mean, it couldn't be better, could it? So it is a match made in heaven today.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting us.
Cato, Wasden, Sea Cadets, we've been recruiting cadets to join the Sea Cadets.
Hi, my name's John Galvin, I'm part of the Sea Cadets. What we've been doing today is we've been trying to gain recruits and by showing off our equipment and showing off our skills to the public, and just trying to spread the word about the Sea Cadet Corps. For example, first aid, engineering, rowing as well, of course. We do rowing most of the time, but we also do drill, where we just do a lot of marching for parades and stuff. So it's very interesting stuff.
Luke Marshall, basically we've been trying to get recruits to join the unit and trying to show off our skills, just like Jordan said.
And how long have you been a sea cadet?
2¾ years.
Wow, that's a long time. Are you having a good day today?
Yeah.
You had plenty of sandwiches?
Yeah. First one.
Oh no!
Hi, I'm Sam Gaskell and I'm a Royal Marine Cadet. I've just been trying to spread the word of Sea Cadets and Royal Marine Cadets. We do a lot more active work. We do some things the same as Sea Cadets, but we add things on as well. I was a Sea Cadet at first, and then I got convinced by a corporal to join Marine Cadets.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I found it a lot better. I was a Sea Cadet for a year, and I'm coming up on my first year of Marines.
Good work. Thank you very much.
I'm Simon Greenish. I'm the previous director of Bletchley Park.
Lovely to see you here again today, especially in lovely bright sunny weather.
Yes, because, at the moment anyway.
Yes, because you had a lot of days here and a lot of weeks and a lot of months and years where it was both physically and metaphorically raining, really, wasn't it?
It certainly was, financially. But isn't it nice to see it in the current state with lots of people here, and you can hear clapping in the background and jazz groups, etc. Lovely.
It is, and it's a testament to the hard work that you and the team. People at the time did, really?
Yes, we had an excellent team who just struggled through the challenges, and the end result is here to see.
What does Armed Forces Day mean to you?
Well, I think the most important thing is that Bletchley's continuing the tradition of working with groups in the community, bringing them here so that the armed forces can work with the heritage of Milton Keynes and vice versa. It's a sort of win-win situation. And we started that, and it's really good to see that the organisation is continuing with it. And I think with other groups as well.
It's something you can be really proud of, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
Your involvement with that. And even after leaving Bletchley Park, that hasn't stopped your involvement.
Yes, I think for all the right reasons, I'm not involved in the management process of Bletchley Park as whole. It wouldn't be fair on Ian, and I shouldn't do it. But I keep a close watch on what's happening. And I have to say, I think it's very good. You know, all the design work that we did has all been faithfully actually constructed, and it all seems to have worked.
Well, I remember us going round Block C while it was still being, well, knocked apart still.
Yes.
And you were seeing the early stages there, weren't you?
Yes.
All that hard work.
Yes.
But, I mean, even since you've left in the local area, you're still involved, aren't you?
Still involved with a charity, particularly one called Ride High, which is very different from Bletchley Park. It's trying to help children who've not had the best start in life and who've got issues, and trying to get them sort of back into good life, as it were. Very effective, and it's helping hundreds of children a year.
So yet more wonderful service to your community and your country.
Hopefully,
thank you
yes.
very much, Simon.
That's a pleasure.
Captain Bill Holland, Milton Keynes, 6th Army Air Corps.
What does Armed Forces Day, and today in particular, being here at Bletchley Park, mean to you? Because you're really passionate about this, aren't you?
I think it was a great government initiative about 5 years ago to start Armed Forces Days. Buckinghamshire, as a county with Milton Keynes, produced an amazing event. And they've continued to do that. But the best thing about it is that veterans over the past 5 years, some serious veterans who went through a lot in World War II, and serving soldiers, Army Cadet Force, and a community come together to celebrate the armed forces, and that's a win situation.
That's the best thing, isn't it? Because it's only been really, and lots of people say this, really since the Iraq War, that our armed forces have been thanked for their service. Because, you know, I know that you're exactly the same as me. Every veteran you meet, you always thank them for their service, don't you? And it's a very small thing to do, but it means the world to them, doesn't it?
It's so important to say thank you. And I think we probably didn't do it enough. But today, you know, the veterans that are left from World War II, particularly, they're VIPs. They're today's VIPs, and we must look after them.
We met today for the first time, but we've got a slight connection, haven't we? Because we both, at different times of our life, have known two men from the Oxen Bucks who landed on Pegasus Bridge on D-Day.
Exactly. And not too far away from us, the front of the Mansion House, about 6 years ago, there was 15 veterans there from D Company, Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire, Major John Howard's men. And two of them, Bill Gray, who you know very well, and Lance Sergeant Titch Rayner, who, you know, was part of my life, a very important part of my life the last 6 years. We both know very well. And Pegasus Bridge, which was the first action on D-Day, successfully six gliders flew in and took the bridge. And everybody knows the history now about the beaches and the bridge and how we advanced through. On the 60th anniversary, we ran 60 miles from Tarleton Rushton Airfield to Pegasus Bridge. And I actually ran as Lance Sergeant Titch Rayner, which is an amazing honour.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, who ran, there was 120 of us, we were all named as one of the veterans, yeah, you know, or one of the actual...
That's the thing I loved about it. It was such a direct link back to that group of men, and they trained so hard and so long for one night. That's literally it. I mean, Titch will have said the same to you. They thought they were getting pulled out the next day, didn't they? Or a couple of days later, and they were there for... Bill was there for 90 days in Normandy.
Yeah, well, both Bill and Titch, you know, out of 120 men that went in on that at 6 minutes past midnight, by the third day, there was only 60 men left alive. So half of D Company had already been killed or injured or seriously wounded. And it went down to about 28 by day four, because the Germans had dug in and their snipers were excellent and the artillery was doing the job it was supposed to do.
And it's good that completely different walks of life, but both of us keeping the memory of those men alive.
And we must do that. And, you know, we must now go into the education process of our youngsters. And it's not about, you know, all the death and the glory. It's about the men and their families and their life. And
the service and the sense of service. Mm. That's, I think that is. And I do see that with younger generation that we see here, showing amazing interest in Bletchley Park, because, you know, they're coming in through the computer side of things and the geeky side of things, but it brings them in, and what they get then is the stories of those veterans. And the listeners can't hear this, but the beaming smile on your face just talking about veterans, it means so much to you, doesn't it?
It's just, you know, we must keep it going, and we must remember them every year.
Thanks very much, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
The story of bravery aboard HMS Petard, which led to the capture of crucial secret documents and cost the lives of two young seamen, is movingly told at Bletchley Park. But theirs was not the only moment of great daring on the seas, which brought intelligence treasures to the codebreakers' hands. Pinching, in other words, stealing stuff, was a highly valuable method in codebreaking. Naval veteran Arnold Hargreaves took part in one such raid on a German U-boat from HMS Bulldog. He looked back on it with podcast producer Mark Cotton, and I asked Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to tell us just how important these opportunist operations were.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
It's easy to think that codebreaking was a safe pursuit and that people were away from the danger. And indeed they were, thousands of people here in wooden huts tucked away in the Buckinghamshire countryside where no one would suspect what they're up to or how important it was. And that was the very point. But of course there was mortal danger involved in some of the process out at sea. And that's where pinches come in. Can you tell us just firstly what a pinch actually was?
Pinching is a term that's used to refer to the physical steaming of code-breaking information from the Germans. In this case, it involved boarding enemy ships and acquiring documents and equipment, bits of Enigma machines, code books, other paperwork, physically from those ships, and then bringing it back and analysing it at Bletchley Park in order to then break the codes over a longer term.
And it's quite interesting to think that people boarding the enemy ships and being told what to look for and what to grab wouldn't have known the significance of those things because, of course, they weren't in on the secret of what systems were being used and what they were looking at and the importance of it.
Absolutely. And this is one of the problems that the Navy has, that in some cases they set up specific operations to try and capture German ships. In other cases, ships are stumbled on almost by accident. And there's one case where the officer who's in the know gets on board the German ship and the boarding party are basically in the process of looting the ship and finding whatever they can find that's interesting. You know, German binoculars are always in demand. And the wheelhouse of the ship was described as a sea of documents where they'd just been pulling drawers out and throwing it all on the floor. And he went in and said, right, I want all of this in bags. And the response he got from the leader of the boarding party was, what, this rubbish? And he went, well, yes. And so it was all gathered up and stuffed into mail sacks and shipped off. And of course, in there were Enigma key sheets, other really vital pieces of information.
Absolute gold, in fact.
Absolute gold for the code breakers. But the guys who collected it had no idea what it was. And the people who were supervising couldn't really put too much emphasis on it. It was just collect everything and bring it back and we'll decide later.
We launched back in December the story of the petard pinch, where two of the three seamen involved in boarding the U-boat didn't make it out, and it made a huge difference. In context of that, you looked into all sorts of other pinches and the breaks that came from them. Obviously, that one has such drama about it because of the loss of life, but there were several others where there was real danger. Can you give us a couple of examples?
The early occasions were when they captured trawlers off Norway and small German patrol vessels, which weren't really a threat, if you like. But whatever the size or shape of the enemy ship, if you're the first guy jumping down on the deck with a revolver in your hand, you don't know who you're going to meet. Have they rigged charges to blow up the ship? Have they opened the seacocks and it's about to sink under your feet? Is there somebody hiding downstairs ready to sell his life for the Führer? You just don't know. And in the case of U-110 and the petard incident, U-559, you've got people climbing down these very narrow hatches in the conning tower of the submarine with no idea what might be down there. And it takes quite a lot of bottle to do that, I think, to be the first one down the hatch. In both cases, there was no one down there ready to fight them.
So it was dual purpose. They were boarding to take the ship, if you like, to take control of it and actually capture it. Or were they boarding once it had been captured, or did it vary?
In the case of the two U-boats, U-110 and U-559, they were forced to the surface by depth charges. And then you have a decision point with the captain where, in the case of 110, Bulldog, they were about to ram the U-boat and sink it, just finish it off completely. When Baker Cresswell, the captain, goes, hang on a minute, there might be useful stuff on board. Let's hold off and not sink it and see if we can search it and see what we can find. And he doesn't have a specific idea about Enigma per se, but he knows that the Germans will be using codes. He's a naval officer. He understands codes himself. He knows there'll be secret documentation on there, which will be important for the war. So he stops the ship before it rams the submarine, assembles a boarding party and sends them off.
Whereas people less in the know would think they're looking for sort of fantastic examples of German engineering and maybe weapons and binoculars
and free stuff.
Yeah.
This is the thing, you know, it's not just paperwork that comes back from these vessels, all sorts of other, as we'll find out, all sorts of other bits and pieces.
Here I am, just around the corner from Bletchley Park at the moment, talking to another World War II veteran, but not a Bletchley Park veteran. Arnold Hargreaves served in the Royal Navy and served on HMS Bulldog. So May 1941 and U-110, that's your real link to Bletchley Park, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you lead us up to what happened? So you were on a convoy.
Ships are getting sunk, all right. Then they ping, ping, ping through, and they got a contact with a submarine, all right.
And where was this? In the North Atlantic?
Oh, yeah, North Atlantic, yeah. About 100 miles or something, off Iceland, something like that.
And were you coming from Iceland to Britain or Britain to Iceland?
I think we was going out to where it was, Canada or where it was, because we used to go halfway.
Yeah.
That we were going out, and they got this here contact with a submarine. And I think it come up from about, where is it, from a bit far than that tree. The submarine, you can see it coming up.
All right, so it wasn't that far.
No, it wasn't that
quite
far.
Quite close.
And the guns couldn't get...
Couldn't so drop down enough.
The bloke, as we was in the whale, there was a bloke firing over your head. He had a stripped Lewis gun.
So the submarine comes up, and the captain asks for a boarding party, does he?
He didn't ask, did he say you.
Well, orders a boarding party. So how many were there of you?
In the ship, because it's a guns crew, I think there must have been 5 to 7 blokes in the guns crew, captain the gun and doers. And it comes through on the earphones, ex-gun man the whaler. So we had to drop everything. Yep. So only one bloke didn't go, he was the captain of the gun, he was in charge of the gun, he never came on there. So we all scrambled down onto the whaler, or sea boat. I think there must have been 20 or 25 people to lower it. You've got to move it out like that. You've got to keep control over it. And if you get 8, 5 of us sitting in there, going to be more weight. There's only 2 ropes holding it. So, clear lower deck for lowering the whaler, all right? So all the seamen who weren't doing any special job, get on the iron deck. So all these chaps have to manhandle these.
They're on the lines and they're trying to keep them.
The inboard one and outboard one. And they have to get so many on here and so many on the rope here. Then you have a rope from the front of the boat, both, holding the doing. As you can pull away. Then you do a slip again. Then you're on your own then it's man the oars. Then there's me and the other blokes are rowing away to the U-boat.
So at this point, the U-boat's surfaced, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's damaged.
Yeah.
And are the crew jumping out?
They're jumping out. Some are jumping out, some are there. But they was all jumped out on the lee side of the submarine here. They all jumped over that side, not side, because they're going to get shot otherwise.
It's the opposite side to
because they're going to get shot to pieces, because a lot of them got killed, see? So they all jumped out there. And as we come up like this here, we had to get on board. Someone scrambled on board there, and a few more scrambled on board there. Then, as they was messing about on the submarine, like we, all of us, this here boat was still nobody in it. And the waves coming along there, and bashed it, and bashed it, and bashed it, sunk. Smashed the whaler. And so, no transport, see?
Before they told you to board, did you have any idea what you were going to do?
Nothing, just go on there and take it over. We were going to get on board and just take it as a salvage or tow it into harbour. So we're getting a few bits and pieces and that together. And, oh, where has gone? Your transport's gone. Yeah. I said, how much is that? Can you swim? I said, now's your chance to learn them. So I think that they had another contact with another submarine. The Bulldog cleared off. We was on a Jack Jones on there. Of course, another submarine might want to torpedo us because they must have a periscope somewhere watching what we're doing. So we all got in there getting bits and pieces and getting bags.
So when you went in the first time, who led the boarding party?
Lieutenant
Baum.
Baum, that's about
that. David Baum.
Yeah, David Baum, yeah.
So what did he lead the boarding party in?
He was in charge of us.
Yeah. So did he say anything to you what to look for?
No,
did he just say grab anything?
Just everything we got. Just fill your bags up, see? Well, what happened was, we got all the stuff there, but no transport, all right. There's another destroyer, and they allowed their boat. It was a motor launch. They call them gasoline gigs. And they did the transporting. When we got all the gear, they did all the moving from the submarine to the Bulldog.
Mixed up in, I think I'm right in saying, the first attack on a convoy which has been actually recorded at sea. We've been attacked by bombers. There have been 2 runs over the convoy as yet. All the ships have been just blazing off like mad. They've got a stick of bombs, but So far, no damage has been done. I've taken up a position by the gun in the stern. It's a 12-pounder, and I'm right amidst the gun crew now. The shells all around me, too, and more are being handed up from the magazine below. I expect you can hear the crew. And wait a minute. Here he comes. He's on our port quarter, not much more than 500 feet up, I should say, and just about abreast of us now. There are tracer bullets bursting all around him. He's crossing the stern straight over, but you can still follow him through this white cloud, and there go his bombs. I think of four of them. They're hanging in the air for a moment. I can see them distinctly, and now they're dropping down over the convoy. But wait a minute. He's missed. Columns of water sprouting up, but he's missed. The ships are still there, and it looks as if we're all right. There's just a faint smell of gunpowder and smoke drifting across the water, but we won't worry about that. He's missed, and everything's okay.
We talk a lot about Bletchley Park's activity kind of in this little bubble in the countryside, not being visibly connected to the war. But actually, you have to remember that the code breaking is affecting the war on a daily basis. People are living and dying because of the information that's being achieved. But also in this case, the battlefield or the ocean is feeding back to Bletchley very directly as well. They're sending information out, but material is coming back in the other direction. The other thing that I think would have been really striking for the people involved in these episodes, and you hear this from some of the veterans, that if you've spent months at sea, sometimes over several years, watching merchant ships being sunk, watching tankers blowing up, men drowning in the freezing sea, and suddenly a U-boat appears in front of you on the surface and the crew abandon ship and they're standing in front of you, the emotions the guys must have felt at that point, it would have been very intense, because these are the guys that you've devoted your whole life to trying to, you know, kill and
you see
stop.
Them as evil. You see and them as the enemy, maybe.
Quite vengeful. I think it's there's a mixture. There's an account from one of the guys on Petard. He says he had to lean over the rail because the German sailor was so weak that he couldn't physically climb on the ship. And he reached down and grabbed him and heaved him up to pull him on board. And while he had him in his clutches, literally, he had a moment of kind of, what do I do with him? Do I throw him back in the sea? You know, do I punch him in the face? What do I do? Actually, it's the Royal Navy. They pulled him on board and gave him cups of tea and revived them. But it must have been a very powerful experience for them to be that close to the enemy all of a sudden. One of the naval officers involved described how his ship had sunk and he'd been pulled out of the sea by the Germans off Norway and became briefly a prisoner of war. But when the Germans evacuated Narvik, when it was attacked, he was liberated. And so he looked at all these Germans jumping into the sea and thought, no, they pulled me out. Perhaps I should go and pull them out. There's a real conflict of sort of seamanship and camaraderie and sympathy for someone else's experience, but also this hatred of what they stand for and what they were doing.
It must have played into it, because as they're boarding, as you say, at any moment they're going to come face to face with Fritz and as likely to be killed as have to make that judgment. They've then had to carry that with them for the rest of their lives. In this research, we're looking at much sort of first-hand testimony accounts of boarding enemy craft.
There are a number of descriptions from different people. The Petard incident in particular, there was a board of inquiry afterwards because two men died and they were potentially going to get gallantry medals. Well, they did indeed get the George Cross. So witness statements essentially were taken from different people involved. And one of the things that's really striking about those accounts is, like all military events or naval events, the level of confusion of people trying to remember what they did at the time and then fitting those accounts together. You get an impression of a situation of lots of split-second decisions being taken and people running about doing this and that and not knowing what's going to happen next, really. I mean, in the case of Bulldog, they lower a whaler, which is a rowing boat, row over to the German submarine, but because in order to get there quickly, they go on the windward side of the submarine. Normal practice is you row round to the downwind side because it's safer. This time, because they're in a hurry, they row to the windward side, climb aboard the submarine. Within a few seconds later, a big wave and the wind comes. Their rowing boat is picked up and basically smashed against the side of the submarine. And it's matchwood. And they're left standing on the submarine going, well, we're here now. You know, we're not going back. Huh. And so they're stuck there. They enter the submarine successfully and realise that it's not imminently going to sink, at which point Bulldog hears of the detection of another submarine and departs to go and attack the other submarine. And basically the boarding party are left on board going, well, we hope they come back and hope the submarine doesn't sink in the meanwhile. But it gave them a certain amount of leisure to go around the submarine and open every single cupboard and pull everything out. And
well, it sounds like there was a lot of booty from U110 brought back.
When all the gear was on the Bulldog, They had bags, like...
Canvas sacks, were they?
Yeah, they were got on the mess deck, and the blokes were sitting on the mess deck, so most of them tipped all the stuff on the mess deck table. Yeah, help yourself. And the blokes said, well, I love that, I love that, I love that. And it all sort of just went, still be in the country somewhere. I've even got a tin out here as well. Got the lamp here, got sword here, got hat here.
What, all from U110?
Yes. Clocks and things and watches and medals and all in the country somewhere. Nobody's asked for them.
When you were inside the U-boat, it was literally anything you could pick up, you put in a bag.
False teeth or whatever.
So you weren't just looking for...
No, just that would come in handy and that would come, like the tin out, you know, yeah. Put it in there. Oh, a lot of little knickknacks, you know, watches or...
So do you know who pinched the Enigma?
That bloke,
David Barr. Yeah. Commander Barr.
He's a bloke. He was a bloke of more intelligent.
Sub-lieutenant, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's a more intelligent role.
So if we go back to when you were at sea, so the initial idea was to tow the U-boat to port, wasn't it?
We towed it for about 3 days with a rope. I think it was a rope, it wouldn't be a cable, because there was a bloke there with a hacksaw ready to chop the wire in case it was sinking.
Yeah, start dragging the boat.
Yeah, and it would have us as well, more or less. You know, when you tow a car, it goes up and down, doesn't it? Because if you break it, the rope's going to go like that and break, isn't it? They put an anchor on there to stop it yawing, stop it going up and down. Then, in the end, towed it for 3 days because we're going to tie it into Iceland.
Mm.
Towed it to Iceland, but 3 days, it sunk because they were going to salvage it, it was. And from there, it's another job, another convoy.
Yeah. So the German crew...
Well, we had a prisoner on board. After we got everything sorted out and the prisoners couldn't see what was happening, on the mess deck, we had half the German survivors on the mess deck. Give them whatever it was, a cup of tea.
Were they put on the lee side of the ship to the U-boat?
Well, no. They're boxed off, they couldn't see them.
So they were actually boxed off so they couldn't
like
see anything?
Yeah, like put them in there and close the doors.
Right.
Because we've got guards on the guard with rifles or whatever it is. We used to let them out on the upper deck after we'd lost the U-boat.
Yeah.
And we were going to take them into Scotland.
While you were towing it, were they kept hidden the whole time?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Till it sunk, then we let them have some fresh air on the upper deck.
You told me about this earlier when we were chatting before we started recording. So tell me again this story about the boat hook, because your duty was looking after the captain's launch, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the one thing you didn't have?
I didn't have a boat hook.
But you did after you captured the U-110, didn't
you? I did do, yeah.
What did you do?
I thought, well, I haven't got it. And I thought, well, as I'm a motorboat's crew, I'm having that for my motorboat. I was in a hurry, like, because I was doing other jobs. I couldn't just hang about and climb up on the bridge. I just sort of slog it on the motorboat. It was sticking up like that. And the captain's doing his head was going round like that. And he must have seen it.
Mm.
And I didn't have anything out of the way. As if they'd have seen it, they'd have known we'd have been on the U-boat.
Yeah. That was so the thing. It was to keep it secret from the Germans, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, where they that boat took is now, I wouldn't know.
But you kept that for the rest of the time you were looking after the captain's launch, weren't you?
In the case of 110, I gather, because they were there for a long time, they had time to sort of scavenge the whole vessel. There was quite a lot, and somebody got a bit of a surprise, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, the captain of Bulldog accumulates all the important stuff, never mind all the other bits and pieces that the crew have acquired. The material that he thinks is of intelligence importance fills 2 packing crates in his cabin.
Wow.
And they are escorted back to Scupper Flow and taken off the ship. And that someone from Bletchley has travelled up to meet them to collect the relevant information. He's come with a briefcase, expecting kind of a folder, and he's confronted with 2 packing crates. So they made other arrangements. One of the paradoxical things about the U-110 capture is that it's famous because it was the first time a complete Enigma machine was recovered from a German submarine. But in fact, the Enigma machine itself was probably the least important item that was recovered in that operation, because Bletchley Park already understood very well how Enigma machines work. And indeed, the Germans' security was predicated on the idea that even if the enemy captured a machine or had acquired a machine by some means, that didn't really matter, because having the machine alone doesn't allow you to break the code. And the wiring of the rotors was also very important. But again, rotors had been captured in previous pinches, and the wiring of other rotors has been worked out mathematically. So the Enigma machine itself wasn't giving us any new information. The key things are things like key sheets and code books. The operation here at Bletchley is divided into 2 strands. You've got Army and Air Force on one side and Navy on the other side. And the reason for that was that the Germans had two different systems of operation. The Enigma machines they were using were basically similar in the early part of the war. But the Army and the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, have a system of setting up the particular settings on the machine that you use to send each message and for communicating what those settings are that is quite basic. And Bletchley gained an understanding of how the Army and the Air Force were using keys fairly early in the war. And it means that by May 1940, with Luftwaffe traffic, for example, they're able to break messages more or less every day. The German Navy, on the other hand, have a much more complex key setting procedure. And critically, it also doesn't rely on the operator to come up with parts of the setting. With the Army and Air Force systems, because the operator had to come up with sets of letters to use, in some cases that was one of the ways Bletchley was able to get into the codes. But the Navy systems were much more elaborate and were based on code books and re-encryption of the settings, one thing another. What this meant was that when Turing first set about tackling Naval Enigma, he didn't make a great deal of progress. And Hut 8 were reading only the occasional message. And even then, they were figuring it out sometimes weeks after the event. So they really weren't getting very far at all. It's only when key sheets, code books start to be captured physically from German vessels, in the Norwegian campaign in particular in 1940. There's a number of captures. There's a ship called the Polaris, which is captured in April 1940, quite near the beginning of that operation. And then the Krebs. Both of those ships provide lots of paperwork that allows Bletchley to read messages from the months to which those key sheets refer. So in the case of Krebs, for example, it was captured in March 1941. On board was the complete key sheet for February. So suddenly Bletchley were able to go back and read a lot of naval messages from February that they hadn't previously been able to look at. But of course, that only works in hindsight. And so the challenge they had was to figure out how to capture this information either contemporaneously or ideally in advance. And that led to two really quite inventive operations, which was the captures of the two German weather ships, the Munchen and the Lauenburg, which were both captured in the course of 1941.
When you say weather ship, does that mean its job was to monitor weather for the benefit of planning of operations?
Essentially, yes. Western European weather starts in the North Atlantic and arrives in a west to east direction. So weather forecasting in Europe relies on an understanding of what's happening out at sea. The Germans in the early part of the war were using aircraft to make weather recordings, but it didn't really provide enough information. So they decided that having static ships, well, they would sail in small circles, they weren't sort of anchored, but ships that went to particular parts of the North Atlantic and just stayed there and three times a day sent all sorts of information back would massively assist in their understanding of the weather. So they sent these weather ships out. What the Admiralty figured out was that if one of these ships was going on station for 6 weeks, 2 months at a time, and was sending back radio messages every day, they would need to have all the relevant code information for the whole of their spell at sea. So if they went at the beginning of the month, they would potentially have that month's sheets and the sheets for the following month and maybe even the month after that already on board. And so you think, well, great, well, we'll go and capture the ship. There's a number of problems with this. The first problem is the Germans were very aware of the sensitivity of this information. So it was printed on basically blotting paper, very water-soluble paper. It was printed in water-soluble ink so that the moment you get it wet, it's ruined. They also had lead-lined bags so that the moment they got under any kind of threat, everything was put in a bag and thrown overboard. It's always made me wonder how the U-boat radio operator spilt his mug of tea. It could all have gone horribly wrong. Presumably they kept their cups of tea far away from their work. You don't want your coffee on the desk if you're in a U-boat. So you have to capture the ship fast enough that they don't throw all this stuff overboard. And secondly, if they are able to get a radio message off saying they've been captured, you risk giving the whole story away to the German. And that could have implications beyond that simple one operation. If the Germans realise that Enigma is vulnerable across the board, it could have enormous implications. A lot of planning and thought has to go into how these operations are going to be carried out. In the event, both the capture of the Munchen in May and the capture of the Lauenburg in June are completely successful. They manage to board both ships. And although some stuff gets thrown overboard by the Germans, other material is recovered. In the first case, Munchen in May, they get key sheets for June, which allow them to read German traffic, not quite contemporaneously, but within a very short period. Again, when they capture the Lauenburg, they're able to get key sheets for July. So again, very, very useful. Unfortunately, there aren't enough weather ships to kind of carry on doing this indefinitely through the war. But what is happening is every time one of these documents is captured, it gives Hut 8 a little bit more of an idea of how the keys are constructed, how the German coding method works. And so they become more able to predict what the settings are going to be. And it gives them more tools so that when they don't have a sheet that's relevant, they can construct one, basically. They can figure out how one should look.
There was lots of secrecy about it, wasn't there?
Yeah, because we didn't know what was doing, what was going on, and what's it for.
So when you got to port, was that when you found out that you'd done something quite secret?
Not really, no.
Were you interviewed when you got to port?
We got aboard, yeah, but the trouble is we had the prisoners on board, took them into Scotland somewhere, and the army took them over. I think they blindfolded them as well, so they couldn't see any ships about it. Anyway, we turned them over to the army, so that was that. Then after a while, these here bods from London have come and interviewed you. What do you see and all that? And they put down a bit of paper, and that's somewhere else up in London somewhere.
So was that just the boarding party?
Yeah, just the boarding party, yeah.
So were you separated from the rest of the crew?
No, just part of the gang.
Yeah, they didn't sort of make it a big deal that you've done something.
Another job, you'd just been down to get the milk, you know.
So were you told not to talk about it?
We're told not to say we've been, yeah, that's it, yeah. Because not until I got mentioned in dispatches, and that's the only time the wife knew.
Then, as you say, it was just back onto another convoy.
Yeah, another job.
It's been an absolute pleasure to sit here today and talk to you, Arnold. It's a fascinating story and a brilliant life, and all down to being a gymnast and eating well and keeping fit.
That's it, and a bit of fresh air.
I'm intrigued to think about what German Naval Command must have thought about the capture of these ships. Were they aware of our purpose and that it was about intelligence?
They weren't aware that it was about intelligence. They were aware that the ships had been captured, obviously, because they went off air, stopped sending weather forecasts. And in one case, one of the ships got off a message saying, we're being chased. But it was an inevitable risk of being out in the North Atlantic for long periods that the Royal Navy might find you.
There's a bit of a myth, isn't there, that the Germans believed Enigma to be unbreakable. Several stories of naval Enigma don't bear that out, do they? Because they were more security conscious than the idea that they thought it was unbreakable would suggest. There were modifications and changes and kind of protective measures that don't suggest to me an arrogance or an assumption that it wasn't ever going to be broken.
I think that's the case. I mean, the navies in the Second World War and previously were much more cryptographically aware anyway, because its codes and ciphers have been much more of a part of naval life than they were of warfare on land. So they were always aware that their radio traffic was vulnerable, and they do bring in a series of different security measures as the war goes along. And indeed, they launch a number of inquiries into Enigma specifically and their code breaking more widely to see whether anything has been broken. Fortunately for the Allies, each of those inquiries comes back saying, there may be problems, but it's probably not the Enigma. One of the German investigators comes back and says there are a series of circumstances that would be required for the Royal Navy to be reading German Enigma traffic. He says, firstly, you need a machine. Secondly, you need the key sheets. Thirdly, you need the plugboard settings. He listed a whole series of scenarios, and he said, while any one or two of these is possible, the likelihood of all of them happening is so unlikely that I think we're safe. Actually, Bletchley Park had achieved the extremely unlikely.
And there you have the scale of the achievement of what was done here. It's staggering.
Dawn, 30th of October, 1942. A periscope and the outline of a submarine are spotted by a Royal Air Force patrol aircraft in the eastern Mediterranean. This sighting will be a vital turning point at Bletchley Park. HMS Batard and three other warships are on the scene by 10 a.m. and spend the next 10 hours hunting and depth charging the U-boat. Night has fallen when the submarine is finally forced to surface after sustaining serious damage. Chaotic scenes unfold as the enemy crew start to abandon ship. Knowing the U-boat could contain vital intelligence which could be utilized by the Allies, Tanny Fasson, the first lieutenant on Petard, and able seaman Colin Grazier immediately leap into the sea and swim through a mass of fleeing U-boat men towards the U-559. They are followed by Naffy canteen assistant Tommy Brown. Cold and wet, Fasson and Grazier board the submarine, climbing down the conning tower into the blackness below. Whilst the U-boat is gradually filling with water, the two men hand various Enigma treasures to Brown, who, after exploring the engine and control room, has positioned himself on the U-boat's conning tower. "Abandon ship!" Brown screams, and plunges into the dark waters to be rescued by the boat crew. At that moment, the ill-fated U-boat suddenly takes in an enormous amount of water and rapidly sinks, taking Tony Fasson and Colin Grazier with it. The bodies of Fasson and Grazier were never recovered. Almost certainly they drowned, trapped in the sinking submarine.
This was an important contributor to what was able to be achieved here, because without these treasures, without these pinches, I think Petard made a particularly dramatic difference, didn't it? Because wasn't that the 10-month sharp blackout?
In the beginning of 1942, the Germans take one of these security measures. They introduce the so-called four-rotor Enigma, the M4 machine. The fourth rotor doesn't turn and it's not interchangeable with the other rotor, so it's not strictly a four-rotor machine, but it's a much more complex machine than the M3 they were using before. And one of the consequences of that is that Hut 8 can read no U-boat traffic for most of the rest of 1942. They're shut out completely because all of the methods they've been able to develop on the back of the pinches in 1941 essentially become redundant. And the bomb machines that they're using to look for settings are based on three-rotor Enigma machines. So you can do it on a three-rotor bomb, but it takes vastly longer. You have to set it up over and over again. And so they're not really reading anything of U-boat traffic until in October, again largely by chance, U-559 is boarded, having been attacked and driven to the surface by HMS Petard and a couple of other ships. And there they recover, again, not Enigma machines, but code books. And the books that are recovered there are vital in allowing four-rotor Enigma to be read. And it's only a few weeks after that pinch that we get back into four-rotor traffic and continue to read it, basically for the remainder of the war. So that pinch was absolutely vital.
And the difference that must have made to what was actually going on in the Atlantic.
It does make a huge difference.
"We ask no favours of the enemy. We seek from them no compunction. On the contrary, if tonight the people of London were asked to cast their vote as to whether a convention should be entered into to stop the bombing of all cities, an overwhelming majority would cry, 'No, we will mete out to the Germans the measure, and more than the measure, they have meted out to us.' The people of London with one voice would say to Hitler, 'You have committed every crime under the sun. Where you have been the least resisted, there you have been the most brutal. It was you who began the indiscriminate bombing. We remember Warsaw in the very few days, first few days of the war. We remember Rotterdam. We have been newly reminded of your habits by the hideous massacre in Belgrade. We know too well the bestial assault you are making upon the Russian people, to whom our hearts go out in their valiant struggle. We will have no truce or parley with you or the grisly gang who work your wicked will. You do your worst, and we will do our best. Perhaps it may be our turn soon. Perhaps it may be our turn now.
Again, with all aspects of the Bletchley Park story, code breaking is only one aspect of victory in the Battle of the Atlantic. There were other developments going on through 1942 and 1943, better air cover, better radar technology, better tactics that led to the Allied navies being successful. But there's no doubt that code breaking was an absolutely vital ingredient in that bigger cake. As Harry Hinsley has always argued, without the code breaking, potentially the battle in the Atlantic would have taken longer. And you can't have D-Day unless you control the Atlantic, basically. The Americans can't get here to fight unless they come across the sea.
It's easy to think of code breaking as a sort of a dry land paper and pencil activity and some very clever machines that were invented along the way. But without that frontline daring, they wouldn't have had the materials to work with.
Absolutely not. That's the key thing, especially on the naval side. Hut 8 would have been useless without people at sea jumping on ships, boarding submarines, putting their lives at risk to gain material that Hut 8 could then use as tools to break the codes.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.